morning, good afternoon, good evening. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of SMIE Consulting's Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and this week we'll be taking a look at three important issues in this week's international education news feeds. And we're going to be coming to you today, as we do each week on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, live with our thoughts on three important issues in international education news. And we always start off with a review of how to get in touch with us at SMIE Consulting. First, our website, smieconsulting.org. You can also catch us here live on Wednesdays on our podcast, where we do a review of these three stories. You're able to catch that, and thanks to those who are subscribing to that feed. We also put out a newsletter each Monday called All the SMIE News Fit to Share. And on that newsletter, we pick actually three of the stories from that each Monday to highlight on the roundup each Wednesday. So get the news stories early and guess which stories we cover on Wednesday in the roundup. So thanks again for joining me. We're excited today to be coming to you today. This is actually the, particularly with our newsletter, it's the 1 year anniversary of the All the SMIE News Fit to Share. And we're very excited to announce that we will be continuing our newsletter experiment that we began last year for the next calendar year, if not longer. And we hope that you make this a regular part of your weekly viewing or podcast listening. And it's a really an important time in international education, as all of us know who follow what's going on in international ed. There has been quite a bit since the election in 2016. We've covered that here on the roundup. But we're getting to a point now with what's been occurring with the public relations kind of nightmare that is our current administration when it comes to overseas audiences and their impressions of us. It's really an opportunity now to take a refresh look at what's how the U.S. is actually being viewed. And we know it hasn't been all roses and champagne over the last few years in terms of how we're being viewed internationally. But I wanted to touch on something that came up this past week during the NACAC conference in Louisville, Kentucky. A number of my colleagues who attended said some interesting discussions going on. Not only this was right before the Harvard decision came up, this past week, this week on their the upholding of Harvard's admissions policies related to how they use race in their admissions decisions. So that was certainly a hot topic. Everybody was eager to find out what that actual court decision would be. But also during NACAC, they released the annual admissions leaders survey. Something actually Inside Higher Ed produced each year, and the results of this survey are particularly enlightening when it comes to international students. So it covers a wide range, because these are deans of enrollment management and such, but that aren't just specifically working with international, but a portion of the questions that they asked were that were answered by these admission leaders were directly related to international students. And they did... obviously international students for public universities are considered out of state, but in terms of the overall picture here, from these admission leaders, or over 350 that responded to the survey, 58% of the admission directors that were surveyed that responded are concerned about maintaining the same number of international students they had, and that's up over the year-on-year average from this group. They also, these leaders were even more more convinced what at least one cause of their problems internationally were. 54% strongly agreed and 19% agreed, so a total of 73%, that the policies and rhetoric of the Trump administration have made it more difficult to recruit international students. Anyone who's in the industry certainly knows that to be the case, whether it's public pronouncements on immigrants or visa policies that have changed, travel bans that have been widely reported on. All of these have created an environment that has made recruiting students internationally a much more complex circumstance for even universities that have been doing it well for a number of years. So What one encouraging piece of news, I think, or at least from this admissions leader survey that did come out, that I'm particularly comforted by, is that at least slight majority, 51%, say that, according to the results, say that they will increase scholarships to maintain current enrollment levels. And that figure is up sharply from previous years. And 38% said that they were more open to using commission-paid agents in recruiting. Not so much concerned about that part, but certainly them are encouraged by that part, but more so that the majority now are saying that they need to be using scholarship dollars to help maintain or retain their international student enrollment levels. So that's an important distinction, because I think if you'd done that, asked that same question five, 10 years ago, using scholarships to maintain or recruit international students was not a real priority, I wouldn't suggest, at least for the greater majority of colleges and universities that we're recruiting. So it is encouraging to see more institutions that value international students and in their on their campuses putting their monies where their mouths are in terms of the willingness to support them in their international student enrollment plans. So that's a little bit of an encouragement piece coming out of that conference. It is a conference each year that attracts thousands of admissions professionals on both the counseling side, on the school side, and on the desks, from the admissions desk side. So it's that kind of report. It's a kind of a bellwether for the admissions industry. There's also a lot of data in there about institutions that are no longer making their class numbers. They had previously done how many of you are making your class numbers expectations, bringing in your class by May 1st when deposits are typically due. And that number was way down, other than private colleges, selective institutions. They last year it added how many made your class by June 1st, and that number has gone down even as well. Where this year they added a July 1st, how many have made your class by July 1st, and 61% of public institutions were saying that they are they're not making their class by that deadline. 61% of public community colleges, 52% of private bachelor's colleges were not making their classes. 46% of private doctoral and master's degree institutions were not going to be making their classes by July 1st. So that's a significant increase, and that's something we all should be paying attention to in terms of all overall enrollment trends, that students are now waiting later. They are keeping their options open, and I think those issues are only going to be exacerbated when you consider NACEC's additional stance that they were forced to change their code of ethical principles and practices this past week, where they removed language that had prevented institutions that were NACEC members from having, after the May 1st date, going after new freshmen and transfer students with improved aid offers and being more, considering more of an open market, an open season on students beyond the May 1st deadline for deposits. So that's presenting a whole other set of issues that will potentially force institutions to become more competitive. How that will impact the international realm, I'm not too sure. But certainly in terms of what we're looking at for international students, the domestic challenges in terms of bringing in classes can potentially have knock-on effects. In the past, in 2008, institutions started when the Great Recession happened. There were a lot of public institutions that moved towards international as kind of a solution. We talked a couple weeks ago about that not probably being the case in as large in numbers and ability to sustain an economic challenge that institutions face in a downturn situation, that they won't be the answer necessarily because of other external factors, particularly the view of the United States, how the U.S. is viewed, as we've talked about, in the world, but also other countries that are becoming increasingly attractive for international students. So The landscape has changed since 2008 and the last economic downturn, and we're seeing certainly with this latest round of potential bad economic news and the current industry talk being fairly realizing that institutions have to be doing more if they want to stay competitive. Perhaps there's an awakening on some circles that for international education and to really thrive on their campuses, that institutions will have to do quite a bit more to really compete. And bottom line, that's what we're talking about. And as we move on to our second topic of the day, when we talk about how the landscape has changed internationally in the last decade, certainly, part of that challenge and the way it's changed is not just economically and other issues that are impacting U.S. colleges and universities. You also see that we see other countries becoming much more competitive and attractive destinations for international students. And yes, there are many more international students studying abroad for their degrees than there were 10, 15, 20 years ago. We look at just the numbers from Open Doors that, yes, the numbers coming to the United States have gone up, basically doubled in 20 years. You see in other countries have also increased their share, their percentages of international students studying on their campuses, where it's in the past we've seen the U.S. having 25 to 30% share back in the 1990s, 30% share of the international student market when 1.7 million students might have been studying outside their own country. Now the U.S.'s share is down to 22%, and that will continue to decline as more destinations become more highly sought after, perhaps, or equally sought after as the United States. So when we look at what that means, and the value of international education globally, we have seen for a number of years in the U.S. Produced by NAFSA, that's published at the same time as Open Doors, the economic impact statement they put together that has said anywhere between $39 and $42 billion is the economic impact of international students being in the United States in terms of the tuition dollars they bring and the money that they spend in our communities, the jobs that they create to help manage those students once they're in country. So that's all been documented for a number of years. But now when we've seen for the first time in the last month or two, we've seen a couple of different surveys that have looked at the global impact of international students studying outside their home country. And this, friends at Study Portals produced, and Rahul Chadha that we've talked about many times before, they put out a report 3 weeks ago that outlined over $300 billion impact. And that's with 5.1 million mobile students internationally in 2016, that their contributions to the world in terms of the countries that they studied in was about a $300 billion industry. We talked about that here on the roundup, and that certainly opens your eyes to, I think, the not just the impact in the United States, but to the world of what international students bring to universities, to the towns that they study in. It's just really a phenomenal amount on their impact, $300 billion. From that study, and the Study Portal study, I should say, what was interesting about their numbers, when they looked at the United States, they actually had a much larger figure for the economic impact. I know we talked about $39 billion for what the NAFSA economic impact statement said in 2018 during the Open Doors report. There was a Commerce Department's commercial service report shortly after that in December. I think that said $42 billion was the impact of international students. This Study Portal survey now says it's $57.3 billion just to the United States, and that's with a percentage of the internationally mobile students of about less than actually 19.1%. So, looking at the global numbers of the 5.1 million students studying outside their home countries. So this report is really eye-opening in a lot of ways to think, and the folks at INTED put this together in context of not just international education in the U.S. or international education globally, They also put it in context of global industries. Automobile sales, for example, is a fortune outside of government military contracts. Automobile sales is the largest private industry at $4 trillion. Tourism next at $2 trillion. Cell phone service at $1 trillion. Fast food restaurants, $856 billion. Internet service providers, $687 billion. Investment banking and brokerage services, $313 billion. And looking at international education, they come in right about tied with biotechnology at $301 billion. So that's on global industries and the kind of scale that we're talking about for international education. Looking at just those numbers, that puts international education as in the top seven or eight largest global industries, non-governmental industries that exist. Looking at the raw numbers here from this report, this INTED version of this report, this revenue data here, it looks at only as three other industries that are not as lucrative for in terms of value add to their countries is beer manufacturing, $216 billion, book publishing, $112 billion, and cheese manufacturing, $109 billion. So two of my favorites on that list that are less less revenue to the countries that they operate in than international students. So that's quite a hefty amount. So we look at those numbers, and it helps to give perspective. And yes, this list that INTED has put together is not a comprehensive list of all the major industries in the world, but it certainly highlights the value of international education on a global scale. Not just from the United States and the varying numbers that you hear about impact of international students in the U.S., but to think of the biotechnology industry and how huge that is to be on par globally with how much of an impact biotechnology has revenue-wise, over $300 billion, that's pretty significant. So it'll be interesting to see how much more we see on those kind of surveys in the weeks and months to come. But certainly that kind of helps put things in perspective, I think, in terms of what we do in international education and the kind of perspective and value that what we do has on not just our own countries, but the world on a macro scale. So part of the whole competitiveness argument that we've talked about before here on the roundup is why particular countries become more popular for international students over the years. One thing that in 2008, when there was kind of a great recession here in the U.S., one of the landmark bills that was introduced, wasn't a bill, but certainly one of the landmark changes that impacted international education positively in the United States was the introduction of STEM OPT. That added an extra 2 years of potential work permission to students who were studying in science, technology, engineering, and math fields. Those numbers since 2008 in the STEM fields have just grown exponentially. Corresponding that time is also when we had the big Chinese initial boom start that started with undergraduate Chinese starting to overtake graduate Chinese students in the U.S. There are a lot of things that happened around the same time. Shortly before that, we had the reintroduction the expansion of the Saudi Arabian scholarship programs, the Brazilian Scientific Mobility Program scholarships, and those events led to the kind of a gravy train that we had experienced here in the U.S. from the late '90s to the last probably the middle of the teens here. So what we see now is frankly, with international education globally, is one of the factors that's making it much more competitive is that that nations are seeing it as a major revenue source for their countries and are putting designing their system, frankly, and the U.S. system hasn't been really designed this way, has been a way to attract the best and the brightest, not only for universities, but find and create pathways for those individuals that come to stay. And that's one thing for anyone who's been an international student advisor for more than a minute. You realize that when students come and they start asking about work permission, and when you get to the end of their degrees, they're talking about OPT, STEM OPT, and all the extra work that needs to be done to make that happen. The system itself is not set up to make that process an easy transition from student to work, and then to work visas and potentially permanent residency. It's an incredible backlog of applicants for OPT, for H-1B, for permanent residency. All of those are incredible obstacles that our system in the U.S. is not, even though we're a country of immigrants, we are the great melting pot. I'm an immigrant. When I came as a five-year-old boy and was on an L-2 visa, my parents came to the U.S. for a better opportunity, for a job that my dad had at his company, sent him here to the United States or brought him to the headquarters, and that's what got me here. And thousands and hundreds and thousands of others in the last 40 years that I've been in the United States have followed similar paths to come to this country for a better life, for education, for employment. Other countries, and it was a long and fairly broken road that helped our family become eventual citizens. But in other countries, that process has become much more streamlined. And yes, we still have the best universities in the world, but the process of, for those that want to come study and stay, work, is not an easy one. In fact, the students that come in are on non-immigrant visas. And yes, they can eventually get an H-1B, which is still a non-immigrant visa, and then transition to a permanent residency green card situation. But that process is one that, from the outset, the deck is stacked against them having that opportunity. The current president has said, we want the best and the brightest here. We want more talented, skilled migrants coming to this country. And those that are coming for study are potentially the best pipeline for that. Those needs to be met. And that's something that we don't allow in our current system. Countries like Australia, like Canada, and increasingly now the UK have set up, and New Zealand have had set up their immigration systems to provide clear pathways for students that want to come and work after graduation and eventually become full-time employees and eventually permanent residency. Those pathways are clear in all these other countries now. So what we see happening, we've talked about OPT and post-study work in a number of different ways here on the roundup. There was an interesting article that Quartz, an online publication that I've seen pop into my feeds in the last year or so, that looks at this one story here that I've just uploaded to the Facebook page, the countries that let foreign students stay the longest after graduation. And this is kind of following on from the UK's reintroduction of the two-year post-study work visa came back into play after an absence of 7 years. It'll be back in play for students graduating in the summer 2020. We'll have 2 years to find work. This is interesting to look at this list because it has Australia has been at the top of this list with 2 years of time that foreign graduates can search for jobs in country. UK had been 4 months, and now with the reintroduction of post-study work visas, it's actually 2 years as of next summer. Germany has had a year and a half, 18 months, as their standard for a number of years. Austria, Lithuania, Norway are in the process of increasing from 6 months to a year. And I think this is an EU-wide referendum that passed that all international students should have at least a year to stay in country. So other countries, Chile, have recently increased theirs to a year, Spain to a year. Most of the other EU countries, New Zealand has a year for students to find work after graduation, where they're still in this work eligibility visa category. There are some differences. So there, it is kind of apples and oranges here, because in the U.S., though students can be approved initially for a year on this, and if you look at the chart, U.S. is way down the list. among many countries that are at a year, probably in fourth place if you look at the overall numbers for the minimum length. What isn't part of this list is a STEM OPT that brings it out to 3 years and makes actually that the longest that any student can stay and work. But what is interesting is these are, and when I say apples and oranges, in the U.S., the permission to work is tied to their visa status, their existing visa status when they enter the country. For students, it's a different category. It's a post-study work visa up to 2 years. So this is something that where they can be looking for work, they don't have to actually have a job. In the U.S., the requirements have gotten much stricter. Though it's almost not quite a CPT experience yet, but certainly if you're going STEM OPT, it's more like, yes, you have to have a specific job, specific employer, an offer before you can have that extra work. In the U.S. now, students have to have that job within short order after they've been authorized to work. It's not necessarily just a permission to stay for another year. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. And when I say how much other countries have changed their systems to create these pathways that allow students to stay in country, another story that caught my eye this past week was one out of Canada, where it looks at the explosion of international students at colleges that tend to be more vocational colleges, but also community colleges. One article was referencing students at Centennial College in Ontario that have seen just a huge explosion of international students there. That of all the publicly funded colleges, English colleges in Ontario, international student enrollment rose 155% over the past 5 years, from 86,000 to about 300,000. So that's just enormous increases. I'm sorry. Rose to 86,000 out of 300,000 students in the system. So in their English colleges, and these aren't university levels. These are again vocational and community colleges. That's in Ontario, or in the province. So that's certainly something that has been an incredible draw, because in Canada, as we've talked about before, there's a very clear pathway for those that want to stay and work in Canada to come through as students and have work permission during and after their studies, on campus during their study, or off campus during their studies for 20 hours a week up to, and then after graduation for a period of years after. Now, what this has done is it's changed the dynamic in international education. One immigration consultant in Ontario recently was quoted as saying in this article, "International education is not an education program anymore. It's an immigration program." This is in Canada. "Most students are studying for permanent residence. It has nothing to do with learning." The quote here is, "It's Canada's gold rush and everyone is in this game." So very interested to see those kind of comments coming out of Canada. Hello, Lou. Glad to have you on board here, and hope all is well at Unibuddy in your new offices in Manhattan. Glad to see you on the bucking bronco or bucking steer at NACAC last week. Hope that went well. Seemed like you survived intact in your cow suit. So good to see you on the roundup. Always good to have the regulars coming back. Just to give you a sense that it's. We talked about what the situation is like in Canada with the incredible increases they've had, and that being very much immigration driven, even though they're coming for study. These are students that are coming for the work that they're going to be able to get after graduation. So looking forward to seeing what happens with some of these countries that are now seeing knock-on consequences, that the colleges that are enrolling all these students are having various issues with English proficiency, and students that aren't as serious as perhaps they should be at the college level, not necessarily the university level in Canada. But certainly there's some challenges there, and ones that certainly worth keeping an eye on as that grows. The last story that we have here related to work after graduation is looking at China. We've talked about China here on the roundup before as kind of the sleeping giant that it has very much awoken in the last few years, not just for what it's done in terms of sending students all over the globe for studies, but also in their recent attempts to bring more international students to China to improve the quality of their universities, to internationalize their campuses. They've spent over $1 billion in the last 3-4 years on international education in China, bringing students in on scholarships, for improving services for international students. So there's a lot happening there. But this recent story from ChinaHigherEducation.org takes a look at Chinese graduates, those that have stayed in China for their university study, and their view of the job market. 90% are concerned of recent graduates, are concerned about their job prospects, primarily because they don't think they have enough practical experience before they graduate. That 50% of them list going back for further study as their way to avoid entering the job market because they don't like the prospects. Less than 30% of recent grads in China are actively looking for jobs. So there's some real challenges, I think, not just in the United States, but globally with international education. So we'll see where those all go in the coming weeks and months. So we'll certainly keep an eye on it here at the Roundup, but I want to thank everybody for making the effort today to join us for the watch party, and those that are listening on the podcast, thanks again for your support. Be sure to subscribe to the newsletter that comes out each Monday. The link to it is to this week's edition is in the comments section on the Facebook page. You can also find that at smieconsulting.org/subscribe. We look forward to talking with you all again next week. But for now, it's all from me, and have a wonderful week.